This Week in Radio Tech, episode 269, is brought to you by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. By the family of ZipStream audio processors and stream encoders, including the astounding ZipStream 9X2. And by Axia Audio Consoles. Six console models with thousands of options. Join the largest AOIP console family on Earth. The SBE is the only organization devoted to the advancement of all levels and types of broadcast engineering. And for two consecutive terms, the SBE's members have elected Joe Snelson as president of their organization. Joe joins us to discuss the terrific educational and career advancement opportunities from SBE, as well as some regulatory issues from SBE's perspective. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. I'm so glad you're here, and it's a delight to be doing this show today. And I mean, I know you hear me say that almost every week, but this is great. First of all, we've got, as usual, our terrific co-host from Manhattan, and I'll better introduce myself first for just a second. I'm Kirk. I'm the guy who kind of founded the show some years ago. We're up to episode 269 now, and I work for the folks at Telos, Telos Omnia, Axia 25/7, and Linear Acoustic. Try not to let that bias me, but I am informed quite a bit by the technology that I'm familiar with from those companies. And also, I occasionally do TV weather, so I have a little bit of experience with that. And I'm part owner of some radio stations. I own the part that doesn't make any money, so that's why I work for the guys at Telos. So I'm coming to you from my studio here in Nashville, Tennessee, by Skype to the GFQ studios. I haven't said all that in a while, so I thought I'd better get that out and kind of set the stage. Now, let's go to the other stage that we almost always talk to, and that is Chris Tobin in Manhattan, the best-dressed engineer in radio. And, well, there's part of every engineer's good dress.
Oh, there we go. Signal. Hey, look at that. Live in living color from Manhattan. Hello, everyone.
Hey, man, it's good to see you.
Oh, it's good to see you. It's a great day here in Manhattan, and the weather is unbelievable. Who would have thought?
Yeah, unbelievably good.
Unbelievably great. Low humidity, the blue skies, the sun is very bright. Actually, the lighting I'm using right now is sunlight bouncing off the buildings across the way. They have white brick, so it's perfect.
That's great. Good color temperature there. I'm in a studio with some fluorescence and try to get that adjusted too. So, Chris, you're the guy who you've got years and years, decades and decades, and millennia of radio engineering experience. And you have taken that experience out of the grasp of a regular taskmaster. And now you're on your own doing IPcodex.com. Tell me about what you do for people.
I just try to help people use the technology IP for the outside broadcast, studio design, things of that sort, even transmitters. You know, ISDN is sunsetting slowly but surely across the nation. In larger cities, it's still around, but some of the smaller cities and medium-sized markets are starting to lose it. And I've been just helping folks out, and it's been fun. And I've worked with a couple of internet radio groups that are now starting to look to do broadcast-style programming. So even though radio folks may be thinking things are dying on their side, it's actually growing with IP. So now is the time to learn the technology.
It sure is. You know, I just heard from a guy we've never had on the show before, Tom Hansen. He's an engineer here in Nashville, works for Lightning 100. Actually, Tom was the first engineer in Nashville to install any audio over IP gear in his studio. At Lightning 100, that was almost 10 years ago. And Tom is consulting and building a studio for an internet-only radio station that is originating the programming right here in Nashville. So, yep, it's this internet's the coming thing, isn't it?
It's great. You can do a lot of stuff. I'm having a ball. Well, I'm sure you are, too, with the Axia.
Yeah, Axia streaming and even shows like this, trying to figure out more ways to use it. Hey, let's bring in another engineer, a guy with a lot of experience as well. And that is, I'm very proud to say, my colleague at the Society of Broadcast Engineers. He is the president, elected president. So you, if you're an SBE member, you helped elect him as the president of the SBE. He's a television engineer, although he got started in both TV and radio. And I'm talking about Joe Snelson from Las Vegas. Hi, Joe. Welcome in. Glad you're here.
Hi, Kirk. Thank you very much. I was listening to you and Chris talk about a little bit about the weather. At least Chris was talking about the weather in New York, and
he gives the forecast.
I'm using natural light for myself, And it's coming in from my office window. However, it is very dark and cloudy outside here in sunny Las Vegas. Not. And who knows? I could end up with a thunderstorm before this thing is over with.
They happen in Las Vegas, but certainly not every day, every week, or not even every month, right?
That is very true. But I have seen times when it's been, I guess, what they would say in Texas, a toad strangler.
Well,
I've seen it.
I've seen radar. I've seen pictures. When Las Vegas does a thunderstorm, you guys tend to do it right, don't you?
Yes. In fact, I think I just saw lightning.
So, Joe, we're going to be talking about a lot of things SBE, but we're also going to be covering some technical subjects, especially those that SBE is involved with, and maybe a few other things that you might want to mention. Why don't you just take a moment and give us, you know, the elevator speech on Joe Snelson? What are you doing? You work with Meredith Corporation, big TV company. What do you do with those guys?
I am the vice president of engineering for the Meredith Local Media Group. I've been with Meredith coming up on 35 years in December. Been in broadcasting for 45 years, and it's been a fun ride. So it's been very enjoyable, but 35 of them with Meredith.
Well, we're going to jump right into some conversation in just a minute with Joe Snelson and Chris Tobin along, too. A lot of it will center around SBE. We've got information coming about handbooks that exist now and those that are coming out. Plus, I want to chat. I want to promote SBE vanity addresses that are available for email, NS workshops, and webinars that are available to you, all kinds of things like that, plus some regulatory matters that the SBE represents the concerns of engineers before the FCC with comments and filings and so forth. Plus, we're going to get some good stories from Joe about some of the things he loves to do toward the end of the show. Our show, speaking of our show, is brought to you in part by our friends at LAVO. That's LAWO, German company, so it's pronounced LAVO. And they're the makers of this. Well, they make, you know, big audio consoles, great big consoles for TV stations, for big venues, you know, symphony halls, for television trucks. And they also have a line of radio consoles. And the really interesting one that we're talking about for LAVO is the Crystal Clear console. You saw a quick web page. Yeah, right there. That person who's touching something there, they're touching a multi-touch monitor screen. It is, it actually, the console itself is an app that runs on a Windows machine, and it just takes over the whole machine, takes over the whole screen. You never see any vestiges of Windows there, and it just looks like a beautifully well-designed audio console from LAVO. So you can touch the screen, you can move faders up and down, you can turn things on and off, and the buttons are big. The faders are big. They're easy to hit with a fingertip. I've tried this myself at the LAVO booth at the NAB show, and it's an interesting, you know, it only takes you a few seconds to get used to this. And what's very cool about it is when you touch a button on this screen that is your audio console, it's contextual. It knows what it can do and it knows what it can't do. And it doesn't give you any options that are not applicable or that you can't do with that button right now. So everything that's presented to you or, you know, to the operator, to the engineer on that screen is entirely contextual. Now, the console itself, you know, the guts, the inputs, the outputs, the audio mixing engine, the where it stores your setups, the power supplies, all that is contained in a 1RU rack unit that can sit anywhere in your studio, in a rack room or a tech center somewhere. It's just wherever it's convenient to bring audio, all your audio ins and outs to. It also sits on the network. So this one rack unit box, and this is the Crystal console box, it has some mic inputs, analog inputs and outputs, AES inputs and outputs, and it also has a network connection. It does Ravenna, and it also does AES-67. So if you're interested in audio over IP, well, you can plug this console directly into any other brand of AOIP system that does AES-67 and get that audio in and out by the AES-67 standard that everybody now is going to be building to. It has dual redundant power supplies available, and it's just a really awesome product. Also, you can take this multi-touch touchscreen monitor. It's got the computer built in the back of it, and you can move it if you need to. If you need to vamoose out of Studio A and go to your office down the hall, plug it into the network, and you're controlling your radio station once again. If you, by the way, you unplug it, if you reboot that computer that is the console for some reason, the mix engine doesn't quit. It just keeps on doing what it was doing. So you stay on the air, and it's just an amazing product. I've always loved the idea of a touchscreen to run a radio station. And the folks at Lavo have taken a step forward to make that happen. You want to check it out? There's a video on the webpage for this. Mike Dosh, the director of Virtual Radio Projects, explains how the Crystal Clear console works in about a 8 or 10 minute video there. Check it out at Lavo, LAWO.com. Look for radio products and then look for the Crystal Clear console. Thanks, Lavo, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Joe, Chris, and I are here to either pepper you with questions or just to elicit some information. Let's chat about education. Education is important to me. I know it's important to Chris. We love to see materials available for engineers, not only for ourselves, but for other colleagues as well. Me and kind of the sales and marketing business with Telos, it's also very helpful when our customers are well-informed. Makes for a much better conversation about, you know, how some kind of technology works. Joe, talk to us about your feelings about SBE in the realm of broadcast engineering education.
Well, Kurt, education is one of the key points of for SBE. And through the years, we have stepped up our educational efforts. And we have a number of things that are going on. Certainly, we have printed materials that many that have stopped by the booth and seen some of the printed publications we have available. We also have a number of webinars, and hopefully everybody has had a chance to take advantage of those from time to time. And those webinars cover all kinds of material from IP to radio to television operations, maintenance, towers, and just a lot of material on there. And if you get a chance, I would encourage everyone to go out to the website, check out the webinars that are available. And of course, our other educational efforts, the NS workshops that take place during the NAB. In fact, I'd mentioned earlier that the NS workshop this year at the NAB in Las Vegas was so full, they actually had to set up overflow. And our education committee chair, Wayne Pacina, did that presentation on IP. Very well attended, a great presentation. So we have a number of things. Our education keeps growing. We keep adding to it. And, you know, with the goal of our education committee to even get up to maybe one webinar a month. And so we keep working on that, and it's growing, and I'm very proud of the efforts that have been made into the education program through the years.
We'll get in and talk about some of the details on these. By the way, in case you notice the video hasn't switched, our technical director lost the internet connection, so he'll be back here shortly, hopefully. So I'm sorry, those of you watching the webcast, you're going to have to just look at me for a minute or two. But we are hearing everybody, so those enjoying the audio version of the webcast are hearing everything just fine. All right, so Joe, when we talked earlier today, you mentioned quite a bit about handbooks. And these are our study and reference materials. You mentioned that there's a TV operator's handbook available. Well, there's several handbooks available. You mentioned TV operators. But you said there's a couple more that are coming out soon that are really complete in their writing and scope. I believe a master control operator's handbook and then a general SB engineering handbook. You want to tell us a bit about these handbooks?
Yeah, the TV operator's handbook just came out very recently. And in fact, if you read this month's edition of The Signal, I mentioned that in my letter. That book was written by Fred Bumgartner and Nick Gerbeck. And it's an excellent book for those that are looking at getting in TV operations. And, of course, I would assume that even many of your listeners on the program here may be cross boundaries into both radio and television. So it is an excellent resource. It's a very comprehensive and detailed resource on television operations. And this is available now. You can go online and you can see it. And if you saw it or heard it, I just had lightning hit very close by here.
I heard the thunder. I heard it. Yeah. Wow.
Which may be why you have an internet problem. So I don't know. It's really going out there. But anyhow, but the book is out. And back when I wrote the Signal article, it was just about to. I had a chance to actually help edit the book and read through it, and very comprehensive and very detailed. So I would encourage those that, like I say, cross boundaries from radio over into television operations to check that out. And then the other book that I wanted to mention and that we were talking about earlier, and it's in the oven, so to speak, even now, is the SBE Broadcast Engineering Handbook. And I think you had asked me earlier, well, kind of what's the difference between that and like the NAB Engineering Handbook?
Yeah.
And this handbook, which we are hoping to be out somewhere near the first of the year, is a, I'll call it an in the trenches handbook. And it covers subjects, you know, pertaining to both radio and television. So this handbook's going to be coming out, we hope, around the first of the year. And as I mentioned in my letter this month, I would encourage everyone to check that out, get a copy, and put it on your reference shelf.
Something that if you go to the SBE website, sbe.org, and you click on the education tab, something you can find is a page all about the different education programs. And in big categories, we have, we have SBE University, and then we have webinars by SBE. What's the difference in SBE University and the webinars themselves?
Well, the webinars, of course, are usually just targeted at a single thing. It may be you know, maybe a single subject material, like we've had that on grounding and other subjects. University would get more comprehensive into a subject. So that material is available. And again, if you want more detailed information, you go to the university, you see the courses that are offered there. And certainly that's a good way to continue your education on a particular subject. And then, like I've even done a webinar too. I think I did one on wireless mic some years ago. So those are primarily, you know, targeted toward a particular subject for the duration of the webinar.
You know, Joe, something I've always liked about the webinars that are offered. I enjoy watching a webinar, listening, and then, you know, asking questions, participating. There are so many subjects, so many webinars that are now in the can, so to speak, that you can go to. A few of them are free, others are paid for, but they're all very worthwhile. Our friend Wayne Pacina, who's been on the show, by the way, did a six-part or more than six-part series on IP networking. Oh my goodness! This was so complete. Starting with the OSI model and layers, and on through IP address management and routing, and an introduction to IP multicast. He really covers these subjects in depth. But it's not just I'm always big on computers and IP, but man, we have HD radio advancement and trends, AM rule changes, leadership development courses, which is I would love to go take one of those classes or courses, and transmitter maintenance checklist. I mean, just a whole list of things. How did SBE get to the point where we have so much information available online? It's just a great resource.
Well, first of all, Kurt, let me build on something you said about some of the webinars being free. That's free to SBE members. And typically in all of our materials that are out there, there's two price structures, those for the non-members and those for the members. So, you know, we don't discriminate whether a person is a member or not, but of course, as a benefit to our members, they get this either for a reduced price, or if the webinar was free, they get it for free. And in talking about building I'll call it the database of the webinars, again, that has been a part of our educational thrust for probably the last, four or five years. I mean, ever since I first got on to the SVE board. So we have ramped up our efforts in education. So that's why you're seeing more out there, and we intend to put even more.
Yeah, well, every time one gets done, obviously it gets archived, and unless the information was ephemeral, that it was only applicable for a short time, it ought to be good for some years. Certainly, the IP networking information is because Wayne, for example, doesn't go into specific models of equipment and how to configure them, but he goes into the concepts that are involved that they apply to any equipment, not equipment specific.
Yes.
I want to. Is Chris Tobin? You still with us, buddy?
I certainly am. Still here. Chris Scher is in the chat room, by the way.
Oh, okay. I wonder if you had any comment at this moment. I've been hogging the conversation as I so often do. I'm sorry.
No. The information, the manuals, the text, all that stuff is ideal, and I'm looking forward to January with the SBE Engineering Handbook. The NAB handbook has been very handy over the years, and so has the ARRL handbook as well. So these three resources at your fingertips in the starting of the new year. That would be great.
So, Joe, we've talked about the SBE University and the webinars. These are on the website, on the SBE.org website. And then this leadership development course. I haven't had a chance to go to that yet, Joe. What can you tell us about that leadership development course?
My company has sent several people to that course, and it is a very good course for those that maybe don't have a lot of management experience, and through that they can learn, how to manage people, how to be a leader. And so I would encourage anybody that is looking at advancing their career beyond just, maybe being a maintenance technician or something, but to move up, into the ranks of management, they would definitely want to take that course, because a lot of the material in there certainly hits down to every day that we do on the job as managers.
Yeah, yeah. Again, if you're watching this, Signal Magazine. Yes, Chris is holding that up right now. This is of course, people communicate all the time on the internet, but it seems like my attention span on the internet is pretty limited. But I take that Signal Magazine, sit down with it while I'm eating, having a break. There you go.
And I'm having some biscotti and espresso while reading the Signal. It's perfect.
There you go. What could be finer than being in New York City on the whatever high floor you're on, biscotti, espresso, and an engineering magazine?
Engineering magazine, biscotti, espresso, and my SBE acrylic mug. Why not?
Wow, there you're prepared. Go. I'm sorry to say I didn't get so prepared. So we have all these tools. Now, we have another tool to talk about, and that's the Ennis Workshops. And I got to tell you, Joe, for years I had no idea what ENNES meant or how it was pronounced. So tell us about the Ennis Foundation a little bit. And as soon as you do, after you do, we're going to look at a quick interview I did with Fred Baumgartner.
Okay. The Ennis Foundation is a nonprofit organization. It is actually incorporated separately from the SBE. And contributions are made to that. And in fact, if you look typically in the back of the Signal, it'll show those that have donated to the Ennis Foundation. And it's through those that we sponsor various workshops, tuitions, tuition aid to students. And there's a number of things like that that occur out of the Ennis Foundation. Harold Ennis was an old-time broadcast engineer, and when I started in this business, interestingly enough, I purchased several of Harold's books and read them and actually helped me develop my career. And so he was rather well-known for his educational efforts, and so the foundation was created after his passing. Been very successful, and of course, through that foundation, we've sponsored the things such as the local Ennis workshops that are held from time to time around the country, and then, of course, the big one typically on Saturdays during the NAB convention in Las Vegas.
Well, I understand that our technical director is getting the problem solved. Also, Andrew Zarian, the owner of the GFQ network, is remoted in also. So we're going to play that video right now while we can. I got a chance, let me set it up here. I got a chance yesterday, to attend the Tennessee Association of Broadcasters convention in Murfreesboro. And I'm always amazed that they include so much engineering, an engineering track to go along with the sales and management track there at TAB, Tennessee Association of Broadcasters. And this year, they did it up even bigger by making it an official Ennis workshop function. And SBE, when we had the idea to do it, SBE quickly responded. Kristen Owens with SBE got involved and got a program put together. And so here's a quick interview with me talking to Kristen and Fred Baumgartner. Let's roll it.
Hey, it's Kirk Harnack at the Tennessee Association of Broadcasters, and they're in the middle here of an Ennis workshop put on by SBE and the Ennis Foundation, and I'm here with Kristen Owens. Hey, Kristen.
Hello.
And you're with SBE, right?
Yes, I'm the Education Director with SBE.
All righty, and also Fred Baumgartner, who helps put these things together.
I'm one of the trustees of the Ennis Foundation.
All right. Who wants to tell me what the Ennis Foundation is?
Oh, I'll start with
right.
that.
Okay.
The Ennis Foundation goes back to Harold Ennis, who can I hold the microphone?
Sure. Go right
and by the way, you got to love the way this guy's energy level comes up when he hands the microphone. Okay. The Ennis Foundation goes back to Harold Ennis, who wrote some of the instructional manuals at the very beginnings of television, and just as radio was developing as an art and science. So a lot of people have Ennis books sitting on their shelves even to this day. Hmm. But he started the whole ball rolling with the educational part, and the local Indianapolis chapter built a foundation around him, did a couple of scholarships, and eventually the national SBE, the local chapter, offered them the opportunity to take over their 401c3. And develop it. And we have over the years, so it's grown over the years. We've done four scholarships or there's about for the last handful of years. We often underwrite the publication of books, educational materials. We underwrite these sessions. We do all the things that are necessary mechanically in order to get the educational effort going. And the person we work with the most, remember this is a volunteer organization, so we need a full-time person who's laser-focused on the topic of education, and that's Kristen. Kristen's had a very good couple of years here. She's just coming up on her second year, and as they say, her metrics are good. Webinar. Well, tell me about it.
Yes. Well, actually, I was telling Fred. I'll let you hold it there. We actually have four Ennis workshops this year, so we've doubled what we did last year previously, as well as our webinars. Right now, I think where we stand, we are on set to meet our goal for the end of the year, so we're ahead of schedule, which is great. And we're trying to offer at least one per month, and we've done at least six this year. So we're kind of moving forward with that.
So the workshops you've had, El Paso's been this year.
Yes, we've had El Paso. We had New York Broadcast Association. We worked with them in June, and then we have this one, and we have one coming up in October at the end in Boston.
Ah, okay.
So yes, we'll bear forth. That will be our four Ennis workshops, and then we have.
We could secretly talk about Tucson, maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. We've had some talks, of one in Arizona for next year, as well as some talks about possibly in Missouri. So that just came up this week. So
and maybe somebody out there is thinking about doing it. No, they answer the phone and everything right there.
Any chance of an Ennis workshop in, say, Hawaii anytime soon?
That I would love.
That is so much on our bucket list.
Yeah. If you're out there, call me for sure.
Now, plenty of engineers can't even make it to one of the four workshops you've done this year, but you said you have a lot of webinars, and I've joined. I mean, I'm not been a presenter, but I've watched some of those, been very helpful. Tell me about how people who are either in SBE or not in SBE can find out about webinars.
Yeah, if you go to our website, you can list, we do live webinars and we also record those webinars so you can view them afterwards because, as you guys know, broadcasters, you guys get called away and things like that. So they're archived and they're on there. The one that we did in July was actually with David Brinder, and he is a common person that you will see on the Ennis Workshop. So if you have never made one of his presentations, we now have an archived version of his presentation under our webinars.
Presenters too. I got to let me put a pitch in for that. Is that like yourself? you bring a very educational program. It's not a sales pitch. It tells engineers how to make things run and get things done.
Yeah.
And we do address that audience that doesn't make it to NAB every year or maybe not every decade. And the reason we move the Ennis workshops around is we're hoping to get to all those engineers within that 500-mile circle and make it. And if you can't make that, then obviously we have all sorts of web efforts out there also, to, as you do, to help educate the industry.
Cool. Fred, anything else you'd like to add about the NS Workshop or the foundation?
And I have to add that we're all real people in real life, and yeah. I'm wearing my SBE hat right now, but full-time I do telecomics for Nautel.
Oh, okay.
So hope to see you doing that along the line here, too.
All right. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate
it. Thanks for having us.
And for people who want to know more about joining SBE, the website would be?
www.sbe.org.
Easy. And they'll find the information about the Ennis Foundation there.
Yes. Hit the tab. This is education, and it'll open a whole new world.
Yep.
Good deal. Thank you so much, Fred, for joining us, and you too, Kristen. I'm Kirk Harnack at the Tennessee Association of Broadcasters in Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
They need to get that guy a better microphone, don't they?
Hey, it's Kirk Harnack at the Tennessee Association.
Stop. I don't want to see it again. All right. Hey, everybody, we're in the middle of This Week in Radio Tech, episode 269, with Joe Snelson, who's the president of the SBE. Also, Chris Tobin is with us from New York City. And tell you what, now seems like a good time to take a break, unless, you know what, I should ask Joe, anything that you want to add about what Kristen and Fred Baumgartner had to say there about Ennis Workshops and the foundation?
Yeah, real quick, Kirk. Earlier I used the word tuition. I didn't really mean tuition. I meant scholarship. And the Ennis Foundation does do scholarships for students. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. And then the last thing, I was talking about some of Harold Ennis's books. I still keep this one up on my shelf, though I do not use it anymore. It's called Television Tape Fundamentals. And on the back of it, it has Harold Ennis's picture. And again, and by the way, I also want to say before I close out here about Fred. Fred does an excellent job putting together the the Ennis workshops, particularly the one in Las Vegas. He's done that for several years. Does a great job at it. So anyhow, again, SB is very proud to be a part of the whole Ennis Foundation and the educational efforts there.
Well, it felt really well put together, especially with Kristen's help too. And it was only a couple of months ago that the Tennessee Association of Broadcasters thought, hey, maybe we should work with SBE on our technical program and make this an Ennis event. And it quickly became that. Hey, you're watching This Week in Radio Tech, episode 269. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tobin and Joe Snelson. And coming up, we're going to be talking about some regulatory matters that Joe will fill us in on, AM improvement, the television band repack. And even if you're in radio, this is interesting stuff. I hear this term and I don't really understand all that's going on. So maybe Joe can help us out. Also, wireless mics, something that's of concern to everyone in the audio business. We'll be talking about that coming up. Our show is brought to you in part by my friends at Telos. There's a new brand name within the Telos Alliance that's floating around, a name that you should begin to get familiar with. It's ZipStream. You may remember the original name of ProStream. Well, we've changed it to the name of ZipStream and added more products to the lineup. And this will be the name for all of our products that have to do with encoding audio for either professional back and forth use, like with the Zip One, and then other products that some of which are new. The original ProStream is now called the ZipStream R1. R as in rack mount and one, first unit. So the ZipStream R1, I've got one of those right over here. Mine still says ProStream on it, but now it's called the ZipStream R1. Then there's other products, software products. You may have remembered a product called Omnia AXE. Well, now it's been improved a bunch. Well, actually, there's still the ZipStream AXE. We've got a new product that I'm using at my radio stations and loving it. It does audio processing and stream encoding as a software package. It runs as a service in Windows, so it's very, very reliable. It's not an application that stays up. It'll just run in the background, start automatically with Windows. And it's called the ZipStream X2. There's another version called the ZipStream 9X2. What's the difference? Well, the 9X2 has Leif Claesson's Omnia 9 processing in it. And that's a big advantage for those of you who want the undo technology and the fabulous declipping that that Leif has got built into his audio processing. There's even more products, though. There is something called the ZipStream FXE. That's a file-based audio processor. So if you're a podcast producer, maybe you produce commercials or commercials for insertion, and you want everything to be processed nicely, evenly, and come out, you know, at the right volume, well, ZipStream FXE will do that. And then there's another line of products that we've been coming out with that are amazing. They're designed by our friends in France at Sound 4. They're called the ZipStream S4. And these are PC cards that do amazing processing and streaming built in. I haven't learned all about them yet. There's so much to find out and so much that they will do. You can go to the TELUS Alliance website and then look for streaming and processing products, and you'll find all these things. I just can't say enough good things about the ZipStream 9X2 software. That's what I'm using at all of my radio stations in Samoa and in Mississippi. We've got, a total of almost 8 that are streaming now. And this is just amazing software with the process. We've got videos about these too. And I should mention that before we close out our spot for TELUS. If you will go to YouTube and then look for TELUS Alliance, you can find videos on so many of our products, plenty of tips, plenty of how to do things. Our support guys record some of the videos. Frank Fodi's recorded some. I have. Also, Tim Carroll has recorded some for the Linear Acoustic brand. And just amazing stuff. You'll find out a lot of education right there at YouTube, at the TELUS Alliance YouTube channel. Thanks a lot to ZipStream for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're back with Chris Tobin and Joe Snelson. Joe, let's go into the regulatory realm. We talked about AM improvement. What's the SBE concerned with on that front?
Kirk, I don't know what happened to my internet connection, but I lost you there. But hopefully I'm going to pick up where you left off there.
I hear you.
Okay, good. The SBE filed back some months ago a filing regarding AM improvements, and of course we've been watching a lot on the regulatory front, and on the AM improvement side, there were 4 major points that we supported on that, and the first one was the elimination of the so-called ratchet rule. The second one was the adoption of modulation-dependent carrier-level MDCL for transmitters. The other one for AM antenna standards was replacing minimum efficiency specifications for AM antennas with minimum radiation in millivolts per meter. And then the last one, which probably is the big elephant in the room, and that is the commencement of an initiative to reduce the noise in the AM band. Mm-hmm. And probably of those 3, number 4 is the big elephant. And so, you know, that's going to be one. And I think when we were chatting earlier, you'd ask the question, why would we even want to mess with this? But the way I look at it is we keep chipping away at the rock. If we stay silent on it, it will just be assumed that everything is fine when everything is not fine. So I think it's important to continue to hammer that. Hopefully, maybe someday it will make some headway. But anyhow, of course, none of us has seen anything yet on AM improvements. And I think I saw in one of the trades today that Wheeler may have mentioned the word, Chairman Wheeler from the FCC. But again, we're still waiting to see.
You know, and it sure will be interesting to see what the AM landscape looks like in 20 years or 50 years. It's been around a long time. Maybe Chris Tobin can have a thought on this. Sometimes, you know, we pontificate a bit here on the show. And it seems to me that the noise picture in the AM band is not likely to get any better. We may be able to hold it at bay, although to me that kind of seems unlikely. But the service provided by AM broadcasters is important and is significant. The wide area coverage is great, although you only get ratings credit for stuff that's in your area, and that's where you really sell to. But I guess in the long run, I would love to see AM broadcasters just afforded easily another place to go. that I may be wrong-headed about that. Don't know that I've thought it all the way through. And there may be a place for a long, long time for 50-kilowatt stations to broadcast and overcome the noise for a long time. I listen, for example, to WLW out of Cincinnati. I used to listen to them over the air for years when I lived in Kentucky. And now I listen to them streaming all the time, and I really enjoy their programming. Chris Tobin, do you have any pontificatory thoughts about where AM broadcasting is going to go?
Well, I think currently, probably in the 5 to 10 years, we'll still see it in some form or shape. I still am a firm believer the only way things will improve for at least for AM is twofold. One, content that has to be compelling and perishable that people can't live without. They'll find the way to listen to the station. And two, need to push for better receiver design. The environment, the electronic noise, the electromagnetic noise field, whatever you want to call it, I don't think it's going to improve any. And we can try our best to try and ask for enforcement in that area, but I doubt we'll see much. We'll see. Who knows? Things could change. But I think if we had better receiver design specs and a push for that, then you have an opportunity to maybe improve things. HD radio receivers are very good. They work very well. They're DSP-based, but they're great for FM. Their AM portion, as far as portable and stuff, is still, I think, a ways off, at least what I've heard. These are the things we need to think about. But the biggest concern I have is just the content. I mean, I miss the days of listening to CHML Hamilton, Canada, 900 kilohertz, and some of the programming that used to come out of there. Now it's just syndicated shows that really don't have anything compelling. And the same is true for many other stations that are heard way beyond their signal coverage area. And even for local FMs, the same thing. So I think that's where a lot of it needs to be focused. But the engineering side of things for SBE, background noise, yes, got to keep chipping away at that rock without a doubt, because that'll force the hand of what do we need to do. And second, receiver design. You just got to get better receivers out there. Because I've had some AM radios over the years where the quality of the signal reception was unbelievable. There was only one out of 12 radios that could do it. You remember the GE Super Radio series?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. That had a great AM section. It worked great in many noisy environments. And yet, it never got, that thinking didn't translate to other product lines along the AM side of stuff.
That's my opinion. I don't know how much of AM improvement is really in your wheelhouse, but as president of SBE, what do you feel like your role is in moving something along for AM improvement?
Well, certainly, and like I'd shared earlier with you, I've done some radio in my years, and in fact, our company owned an AM, a small AM up in the Saginaw, Michigan area. One time. So, and of course, Meredith was very big into radio back into the 80s and everything. But certainly, as president of the SBE, I have an appreciation of both radio and television. And I think anything that the SBE can do that, betters AM and also benefits our members. And I'd say that when we look at any of our filings that we make, we try to look at what cuts across the majority of our members and the benefit to all. Because there are some issues you get into that you may have some members that could be on one side of the fence and some that would be on the other side of the fence. Certainly, the 4 points that we laid out were embraced by the executive committee and the board, for that matter, of the SVE, the 4 points that we laid out here, and thinking of the comment on compelling program, whether it be radio, television, AM, FM, or regardless of what it is, compelling programming definitely makes a difference. And I often use the example of a video, an unfortunate video that all of us have seen through the years, and that is of the Rodney King beating. That was shot on VHS format at night. And if you look at the technical quality, golf ball size, noise going through it, but yet that was, a very highly viewed piece of video. Why? Because people wanted to watch it. They wanted to see what was going on. So, again, I think programming makes a difference. And I will say on noise, I still listen to AM in my car, even going home. But when I would back out of my house in the morning, I have a post lamp out in the front yard that has CFLs in it. And every time the car would line up with that post lamp, yeah, you know the story, horrible buzz. So certainly I am, and even on the TV side, back when we owned some low-band VHF channels before the stations, before the digital transition, noise would just eat some of us up. Depending upon the shape of the power grid infrastructure, and so certainly some help is needed in that area to clean up some of these issues for both AM as well as those that elect to broadcast in the low band via television.
Joe, you mentioned CFL, compact fluorescent bulbs, and those have been such a pain for our quest to have a reduced noise. They make so much noise. I guess the good news is, at least from my perspective, CFLs are beginning to become passe, and LED bulbs are becoming more and more and more affordable. I swear, every time I go to Costco or Sam's, they got a new line of LED bulbs at a lower price than before. I just put LED floodlights around the house here, and I don't keep them on 24/7, but I could because the cost to run them is next to nothing, and they actually look really good. So LEDs are coming along. My question is, I don't know, Joe or Chris, do typical LED bulb technologies create much noise in the AM band? I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I've never tested them to see. Now I will tell you, I put some LEDs in the same post lamp. I took out the CFLs and put the LEDs in there. And to this day, I haven't figured out why, but unfortunately, I did not get the life out of them like I expected to get out of them now.
Interesting.
And that you replaced them once, so I don't know what's going on there.
Chris, any opinion on that? Are you with us?
I'm here. I have not heard too much noise. A couple of the LED lights that I have here at the house, there's a little background noise, but it's much less than that of a CFL. And I'm glad to see CFLs are going anyway, because the mercury in them is annoying to get disposed of.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see that go.
I've had here in my office, I've had really mixed results. I don't know. I have this fetish. I buy cheap Chinese LED bulbs just to see how well they'll do. And some of them do great. And others, I had some here in the office that were replacements for some halogen bulbs. And they lasted about 3 months. And all of them failed the same way. They had a little transformer in there because they were it's 100. This particular fixture is 110 volt circuit. And a little transformer in there. Tiny, puny little thing wound around a little iron core, a ferrite, bead, if you will, and they didn't last. And I don't think the LEDs failed. I think it was the little the step-down power supply that failed them. But I have other LEDs here at the house. Have been going for years. We've left them on. Not a post light, but we have a light front porch and back porch that I just tell the family, leave them on. I'd rather have it on. It costs 2.5 cents a month, to run each one of these things. So let's leave it on. They're getting better, but it's going to be interesting. I'd love to get rid of CFLs overall. So, Joe, there's something that hopefully you can educate us on now, and that is this TV repack thing. When we when it went from analog television to digital television, including HD television, we had a lot of shuffling of channels around there now, and I'm aware that what I think here in Nashville is Channel 2, the ABC affiliate, isn't necessarily on the old analog Channel 2. In fact, I happen to know, I think it's on Channel 27 here in Nashville, even though they still brand the Channel 2. Same for just about every other TV station. What I think I understand that process. What's this new TV repack thing? What's going on with that, and what's the end goal, and how is it affecting people?
Well, the end goal is to make money for the U.S. Treasury.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the main goals. There are some others that have been brought out, but primarily it's to provide more spectrum for broadband, and and so that they can deliver more services via broadband. And so right now the UHF TV band goes from UHF channel 14 up to 51, with, of course, channel 37 excluded. That's reserved for radio astronomy and has been for a long, long time. There's never been a TV channel on it, to my knowledge. And anyhow, so what they want to do is start at channel 51, and the repacking consists of two phases. The first phase being what they call a reverse auction. This is to find out how many broadcasters would be willing to sell their channel to get money for it in a in what's called a reverse auction. Depending on the number of TV TV operators that decide to participate in the reverse auction and sell their channel, that will determine how much spectrum is available for them to forward auction to the broadband people. And then, so you have two phases to it. You have a reverse auction, that's to get the spectrum, and then the second phase is the forward auction to sell it off. And, of course, depending on how much spectrum is sold and how many broadcasters still want to stay in the television business in the UHF band, they will need to repack that. So depending upon how the scenario plays, the UHF, the number of UHF stations will be concentrated to the lower end of the UHF band. So rather than going from 14 to 51, it may go from 14 to 30 as an example. Now, that, again, is not where it's going to necessarily be, because that will be determined upon the outcome of the reverse auction to know how many people are going to participate.
Wow. Okay, so you got to do one first to see what can be cleaned up around the edges and in the middle and various spots, and then auction them back off. Wow. So,
Kirk, if I can add one thing, though, some of your listeners may be wondering, well, how in the world does this affect radio? Well, here's how. The as many people know, the UHF television band has been used through the years for more than just UHF television broadcasting. And, you know, the words that come to mind is wireless microphones. And so for folks that use wireless microphones in that band, the concern is where are they going to operate and go depending on the outcome of the auction? And there have been some recent rules that have come out regarding licensed microphones, and even to the point where they're looking at one of the rules is to open up other bands. Now, you know, before you say, gee, that's wonderful, you might want to also listen to the other side of the story, and that is that those two bands are the 900 megahertz band as well as the 6 gigahertz band. Both of those bands that I'm talking about are used for broadcast auxiliary, of course, 900 megahertz, classically oral STLs, intercity relays, and in the 6.7 gigahertz band, starting at 6.8 gigahertz, that has been classically television STLs and TSLs. And I would certainly assume that an operator would have some concern if somebody fired up a microphone that just happened to be right in line or right in their direct path, with maybe only being, you know, a few hundred feet away from your receive site. So that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. The rules are out, and you can go out and see those on the FCC website. But it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. They are requiring, by the way, frequency coordination for operation in those two particular bands. Again, that's for licensed operations. But as I think everyone knows, licensed is not only just wireless microphones for broadcasters, but also motion picture producers and like that. But at least the scope is narrowed a little bit to licensed broadcasters. Unlicensed is another that's another issue.
Yeah. Chris Tobin in New York City, what are you hearing from your friends who maybe do film production or football games with, you know, 65 wireless mics at a time? What do you hear about either what we've been through so far with wireless mic frequencies and having to move here or there, and what scary things may be ahead?
Well, I know talking to some of the folks from the sporting events and SBE coordination that's been done here in New York City at the ballparks, both in the city itself and across the river in New Jersey, a lot of the production companies, when it comes to wireless, they're concerned. They've been talking about it. They're not sure which way to go, because I'm not sure if a 6-gig wireless mic is something that will work very well in many environments. Then again, I'm not sure if there's anybody making one. And then the other problem is just the number of channels that you need to satisfy, say, a New York City production area, or say Chicago or Los Angeles, or even Nashville. You know, the Grand Ole Opera, I'm sure you would have a lot of wireless needs depending on the event. So, you know, it's going to be a tough one. At the New York State Broadcasters Association conference just past June, SBE was there. We talked about wireless mics and the regulatory climate, and the discussion was quite heated. Everybody was concerned, and the questions were basically, well, what do you mean 900 meg? What do you mean 6 gig? Well, what if that doesn't work? Where do we go? And there's really no answer.
It's a tough problem, and interesting that, you know, those frequencies that are at in the UHF band are usable for a lot of things. We you know, I guess decades ago, Joe, we weren't very good at making compact gear that could use those kind of frequencies, but nowadays it's pretty simple. It's strip line antennas and chips, and it we build stuff that works well. Those frequencies are desirable for a lot of stuff, cell phones and all kinds of wireless data.
Well.
Yeah, they do.
That's why they want them.
Wow. Right. And I'll say it, when I started in this business, VHF, low band VHF was beachfront property. High band VHF was that was okay property. UHF was nomad's land. Nobody wanted it.
You didn't want to be there.
Right. Yeah, and now everything has just flipped topsy turvy, and it's the other way around.
Yep.
But Chris did bring up a point that I want to also emphasize is a concern that SBE has, and if you've read any of our general counsel Chris Imlay's articles in the Signal, certainly the concern regarding the quantity of spectrum that's going to be available. I mean, even before when the FCC allowed two dedicated wireless mic channels either side of channel 37. That was okay, but certainly even there, that is not enough to cover large venues when you get into Super Bowls and things where you have hundreds of mics going and on at the same time. So, yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, wow. We could talk about this for quite a while, and we're going to talk about a couple. We're going to wrap it up with a few things here from Joe at the end of the show in just a minute. I want to tell you that you're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 269. Our guest is the president of the SBE, the elected president. You elected him if you're an SBE member, Joe Snelson. And so he's been guiding very well the efforts of the board of directors at the SBE and interfacing with all manner of people and getting things done at the Society of Broadcast Engineers. Our show is brought to you in part by my friends at Axia. And I want to tell you about something a little bit different this time. And that is that Axia, the entire range of networked audio consoles. They all use audio over IP. And no matter what size broadcaster you are, or whether you have big, important control rooms with, you know, you need a lot of faders, or you have more modest needs, medium-sized needs, whether you just need, you know, some little six-fader consoles on desks to do some dubbing, to do news production, to do interviews, that kind of thing. Well, Axia's got all that. From big to little, they can. There is actually in France. There's a studio that has a two-fader Axia console. I've seen it. I took pictures of it. I've been there. It's amazing. It's a cool little two-fader Element console, and they go up from there to as many as 40 faders. And I think another in the same room in France at Energy. There is a the largest console, the largest Axia console in the world, and they're available in sizes all in between. Hey, I've been to a big operation in Dallas, Texas, where the broadcaster there has, I don't know, 6 or 8 control rooms that are just gorgeous with big, impressive Axia consoles. And then they have some news workstations where they're using much smaller consoles, but they can full function, produce anything. And because it's audio over IP, because it's networked, you can bring in any source you need to. And if there's, if you can talk back to that source, whether it's a talent on some on a mic and headphones, or a codec, an IP codec or an ISDN codec, or whether it's a telephone hybrid, these consoles from Axia will receive it and talk back to it really easily and seamlessly, and the operator doesn't even have to think about how to set up a mix minus. It's just there. So the newest console from Axia that folks are really interested in, and I just talked to one of our salespeople at Axia yesterday. He said these things are just flying out the door, and that's the Fusion console. It's a little bit more expensive. It's a little bit of an upgrade from an Element console because it has beautiful, bright OLED displays on it for everything. As you can see, the audio confidence monitors coming in, the backfeed audio going out, the name of the channel, all kinds of things about the channel. And they're just gorgeous consoles with the way that all the markings are laser etched, double anodized. It'll never look old. It can't, because you can't mark it up. You can't peel anything off. And you can't mess anything. You can't wear the paint out. It is just absolutely amazing. Go to the website for Axia. You can go to axiaaudio.com, or you can go to the new telosalliance.com website, and you go to Axia and look at the consoles. There's a brief look at them right there, from the Fusion through the Element, and then on down to the IQ console, the Radius, which is, by the way, what this very show is being produced on from an audio point of view, a Radius console, and the Desk, which is a compact six-fader console, and the Rack, RAQ. I've got one of these at our news workstation in American Samoa. Our news lady uses this console all day long to dubbing and recording and to produce her newscasts. That's the Rack console, 6 faders in a rack mount. Plus, there's different ways to get the mixing done with our mix engines, either the power station or the smaller studio mix engine, or the Core, the QOR 32, or the smaller Core 16. Some of these mix engines, the cores and the power station, contain their own inbuilt Ethernet switch, which is already configured for audio over IP. Just great stuff. Check it out, if you will, at telosalliance.com under the Axia banner. You're going to love it. If you haven't gotten into AOIP yet, boy, you need to. I sure have enjoyed having these consoles at our stations for, I guess, about the last 6 years now for me personally. Thanks to Axia for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Joe, let's see. Do we have time? We might have time for a story. You told me a little fire and smoke story that was pretty interesting about you jumping into the fire yourself in terms of getting into broadcast engineering. Would you like to regale us with a little bit of information about that?
Okay, I'll try real quick here. When I became assistant chief engineer in Kansas City, we had both radio and television properties at the time. Some years earlier, before I joined the company, they had a fire with one of the particular brand of transmitter that I won't name. But anyhow, it melted the transmitter, and they had to replace it. And I'd heard the story. So a couple of years later, I became the assistant chief there. One of my responsibilities basically was acting chief for the radio station. And I had not done a lot of AM work up to then. I'd done some FM, but I was at home one night when the phone rang and the operator said, "Joe, we got a problem. The transmitter, we're at almost no power." And I tried the backup, and it's not working. And so I don't know what to do. And I said, "Well, let me get out there." So a thunderstorm had moved through Kansas City at the time, and but it had blown through. So I hopped in my car, and it was about a 30-minute drive out to the transmitter site. Got there, and when I stopped the engine of the car and I opened the car door, I heard the thing that new chief engineer wants to hear, and that's a fire horn going off. And of course, what flashed my mind is, oh no, deja vu. Well, at least not for me, but for the company.
Yeah, you know,
all over again. And, of course, I did all the, at least I think, the correct steps. I went up to the door. I did not see any visible smoke from the outside. Even though it was night, I looked around, didn't see anything or smell anything. I felt the door, and it was totally cool. Put my key in the lock. I unlocked the door and just gently began to open it. Just to see what was going on inside, just in case there was a bunch of flames. I wasn't going to provide a bunch of oxygen for it. There wasn't anything, just a little bit of smoke leaked out. And so anyhow, when I went in, I discovered that when the storm moved through, lightning hit one of the towers, one of the lines, one of the 5 feed lines coming into the building, which was like 1 7/8", I believe, something like that. Of course, wrapped with a polyethylene jacket, but it had a splice on it. The line had been spliced. Well, evidently the burn took place at arc over took place at the splice, and it was enough to cause the polyethylene jacket to begin to ignite. And of course, it just kind of spread down the lines for about 3 feet in both directions. So that was my baptism in fire, so to speak.
In fire.
Within just a few weeks after I became the AM chief there. By the way, we did get it temporarily back on the air, and within about a week, once the new line arrived and I was able to get it spliced, measured carefully, and checked out to make sure that we had the right lengths and everything, and got it installed, and we were back up to normal operation.
Well, this was for an AM, right? This was an AM?
That was an AM.
Handling
that
codes?
Was an AM.
Yeah. So with AM, you do have some options that you can bypass. You know, you know, car jumper cables in a real pinch. But if it was FM or something at a higher frequency, you really got it. You don't have much choices there.
That's very true. And I shared with you. I also had to rebuild an FM that the cavity burned up in it, and that was kind of a mess. The foam around the blower had broken away from the sidewall of the blower cabinet, and it went right up into the screen that basically protects the input to the cavity, just a little mesh screen. And anyhow, it clogged up, and the cavity overheated and got very hot. So I spent the night rebuilding one of those too. So yes, I've had my FM and AM stories.
Hey, the first station I ever worked at, a public station, actually was on 10 watts power when I came to work for them, because their transmitter of the same design that you're talking about had done exactly the same thing.
Oh,
so yeah, my first job in radio started at 10 watts. Chris Tobin, you got a fire? You don't have a fire story for us, do you?
If you'd like, I could give you a fire story. Yeah, sure. I got one for you. Many years ago at an AM station, a directional AM station on Long Island, I was covering the engineer while he visited his daughter who was getting married in Florida. So he went away for the weekend. I usually covered for him on holiday and whatnot. So I received a phone call on this Friday evening of the weekend from the general manager, and he's in panic. You could tell he was like crying, because the tone of his voice, the cadence of his delivery of the voice was just such that you could tell something was really, really wrong. And all I could hear is, "It's gone. It's all gone." And I'm like, "What are you talking about? Which part of the facility is gone? We haven't had bad weather. Because you just got to get out to the transmitter. That's all I can say. I got to go. Click." So, you know, it's a Friday night. It's 11 o'clock at night. Weather is fair. There's no reason to be panicked. And I'm thinking, how bad can it be? I drive out to the site. Now, remind you, it's a 4-tower directional, so it's a lot of property. As I'm driving up the road to the transmitter building, several dozen fire engines are passing me by, going in the same direction as I'm going. As I'm turning coming around a curve, approaching the property, coming up the hill, there's sort of like an orange glow on the horizon. 11 o'clock at night. Clear skies, orange glow in a place that's normally pitch black. I'm looking for the flashing red lights, the beacons on the top of the towers, figuring maybe I'm in the wrong place. No, I'm not. I pull up to a fully engulfed, flaming transmitter building firefighters are doing their best to put out the fire as the walls are collapsing. The roof has collapsed. I'm watching this happen. The tower lights are out, of course, because there's no power. Everything is burned down, literally. It was arson, they discovered later on, but I had never seen anything like it. Next morning, we're walking through the rubble, and I must say, I've never seen the inside of a Harris MW1A and the aluminum RF modules, just a mound of aluminum. That's it. You couldn't even make out the fact that those were heat sinks with five transistors on each. Because I used to maintain an MW1A, so I know. For those of you in the audience who are familiar with that transmitter, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Melted. The good thing, the only saving grace, was the phaser cabinet was outside at the base of one of the towers. So we were actually able to get an AM transmitter flown in, and we got them back up on the air in a timely fashion the following morning, and things came together. But it was, I'll tell you, that's one site that, you know, fire to transmitter site is just something. It's never the same in every location, but it definitely makes you appreciate Mother Nature, makes you appreciate many things. But it was just, I mean, literally, it was, the building was just to the ground. That was it.
Joe, I have the next webinar idea. What to do when the unthinkable happens? Because I've heard so many stories of an engineer driving to a tower site and, like, the tower's not there anymore. Because it fell down, or as Chris just mentioned, you know, the building's not there anymore, or as you mentioned, you know, the unthinkable happened. You got this big chunk of coax that's gone. That could be interesting.
Yeah.
What to do when the unthinkable happens?
Yes, absolutely. The problem is they're never the same.
That's true. Yeah. I was thinking more of a psychology class,
class.
Hey, it's been great to have you on, Joe. We've gone past our time limit, but I'm glad we did, and I'm glad that you've been with us. It's so great for you to take an hour plus out of your day in Las Vegas. Is the thunderstorm still going on, or is it passed over?
Yes, it's still going on. There's still flashes of lightning going on here.
Well, as an engineer, I know that it's got to make you at least a little bit nervous. You probably have people to take care of that, but let's hope you don't get a call immediately.
This is true.
Yeah. Chris Tobin, thank you for being with us from Manhattan on This Week in Radio Tech. And folks want to reach you for a little consulting advice, they would reach you at where?
You could try support@ipcodex.com. Hey, just on note, Chris Scher was in the chat room for us. I just wanted to remind everybody that the SBE has been presenting the leadership development courses since 1997. And there's some new ones, I guess, going up on the website. Recently, there was something held at Atlanta. So for those of you in the audience, check that out. And since we're talking education on this particular episode, partly education, on our next war stories, you'll have to ask me about a small paint bucket full of water from Long Island Sound, a 66 block, an 8451 going in and going out to prove that even dissimilar metals in salt water will not affect the audio. I learned that from a young engineer starting out early in his career. He and I reminisced about it just recently at the NAB. That young engineer is now somebody you might be familiar with. Yeah, well, you know what? He's somebody you may know. Next time you see Chris Scher, right now
I
got to
hear the science behind that one. Yeah.
Oh, it's a great story. It's fun. But for those of you who are learning stuff or just wanted to try something different or prove a point, there's many ways of doing this. And this bucket idea was one of them, and it was a great one for someone starting out young and early on in his career.
Great. And Chris, thank you for keeping track of Chris Scherer, who has been in the chat room. And I'm sorry that we weren't able to be in there. Joe Snelson, thank you again for being here. I appreciate it. Hope to see you again real soon, I guess in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes, right. At our national meeting there. And if anyone's listening and is there, be sure to come up and say hello.
All righty. Will do. All right. This has been episode 269 of This Week in Radio Tech. Joe Snelson, president of the SBE, has been our guest, along with Chris Tobin, as usual. I'm Kirk Harnack in Nashville, Tennessee. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.